I'm Marty Moskowain, and today is the last day for Radio Times, a program that debuted in 1987 when a very green host, that would be me, got on-the-job training live on the air. Back then, I could not imagine the show having such a long life. I was largely consumed with surviving day-to-day and figuring out how to become a better interviewer. Needless to say, there was some rough going early on, but over time, I got the hang of it. It has been the most fulfilling job I could ever imagine having, getting to talk to so many people about so many issues, mixing it up with you, our listeners, and getting to work with such a dedicated, smart, and creative crew of producers and engineers. Deciding to end the show has jogged so many memories, which is why I enjoyed talking last week with Dave Davies, Fresh Air co-host, WHYY colleague, and dear friend. This took place at the National Constitution Center before an audience of listeners, staff, and supporters. We talked about the early days of Radio Times, some memorable interviews, the people who have made the program possible, my plans for a new weekly show, and we played an excerpt of a performance by 1812 Productions of my best, Hate Mail. Here's how the conversation started.
So, Marty.
So, Dave.
Big moment.
Big moment.
How's it feel so far?
It feels everything. I feel like the luckiest, honestly, the luckiest person in the world to be able to have had this career at WHYY. It's not entirely over yet, but to have my own radio show, for Christ's sake, and to work with so many talented people and to get to meet people I would never meet as guests. And to feel so connected to the listeners, the response has been overwhelming, and I'm very touched and very moved and very happy. Truthfully, I'm very happy.
You know, when you started that show, this building wasn't here.
No,
it was not even proposed. In fact, we saw it happen. What will you miss about doing the show?
Oh gosh, I will miss doing the show. That needs to be said. Mostly, I'll miss my colleagues, the people that I work with. All the people that we work with at WHYY, it's just a wonderful place where you go to work and people are making things all day long, and you get to experience that and to see that and to be a part of that. So I will miss that experience of being with young people, to be perfectly honest with you, who are doing exciting things. I will miss the show. I won't miss getting up at 5:30 in the morning. I won't miss another show about Donald Trump. You know, there are a lot of things I will not miss, Dave.
That was my next question, but go ahead, yeah.
I beat you to it.
Yeah, yeah. Things you definitely won't miss.
Right? Definitely won't miss.
It is a grind, isn't it?
Yeah. It is a grind.
So, let's talk about how you got here. I mean, like, going back. Tell us about where you grew up, what your parents were like.
Yeah. I grew up in Massachusetts. My dad was a teacher. My mom, I guess we would say in the 50s, was a homemaker. And I lived on a boys' boarding school campus in Massachusetts, which is a pretty strange place to grow up. On the one hand, I had friends and we had, you know, 1,200 acres to go explore, and that was wonderful. But, you know, it is not the real world. And my dad was a teacher there. He taught for 20 years. And then in 1957, he said, this place is never going to change. And so we moved to Middletown, Delaware, to another then boys boarding school that was actually founded by the DuPonts. They wanted to create a British boarding school in the middle of Delaware. Like, who would think of that? And so my dad was the headmaster there. And Middletown, Delaware in the 1950s was a segregated town. And for a young girl like me, with my parents, it was eye-opening to see prejudice and racism up front like that. And to me, that was an education that has, frankly, haunted me my whole life.
And what did you learn from your parents about how they operated in that environment?
Yeah. I mean, my dad, I think one of the reasons he wanted to go to this school is he wanted to make a difference. First thing he did was integrate it. You know, this was 1957, 58, and that was his number one priority. And then, lo and behold, he brought girls to the school. And so to see a father who was willing to, in a sense, put his money, you know, put his not life on the line per se, but who believed in things and was willing to put them into effect. My mom was a much more self-contained, quiet person. She was could have run the EPA. We were not allowed to. We had to recycle absolutely everything, including rubber bands, Pepperidge Farm wrappings. We had to use 5 different uses for that. I remember being really cold in our house because she never turned the heat on. But they were terrific. They were great parents for me.
Yeah, some pieces are falling into place here. So you went away to boarding school.
I did.
And I remember years ago you telling me that you had dyslexia.
Yeah.
So how did that affect you as a student?
Well, I was a terrible student from really the get-go. And I was, you know, when in school you have the A group, the B group, the C group, I was always in the C group. To this day, if you were to hand me a book and just say, Marty, you know, read out of this book, I would stumble through it. I have my little tricks of how to read things, but that was an undiagnosed, probably, learning disability.
Right. Well, in your life for the last 35 years, people have handed you a lot of books to be read in a hurry.
But I read them again and again. You know, it takes lots of different practice. And this is more speaking out loud, but all my scripts I've read 45 times before I say them on the air, just because it doesn't come naturally.
Okay, Marty, but when you're doing 10 shows a week, as you did for so long, and they're not all books, but more than one a week, probably. You read it and read it again? I mean, you dog-eared pages, I would see
lots
this.
Of dog-eared pages, lots of post-its, lots of circling. I mean, I think I learned that I'm a kinesthetic person, so if I underline something and circle it and come back to it, then it will be embedded.
You went to George Washington University.
I did.
Didn't finish.
No.
What made you leave?
Well, I went there from 67, 68, 69, which of course was in the throes of the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, and I went there thinking that I would set the world on fire. Then I realized I knew nothing, and I'd lived this very sheltered life. So after 2 years, I dropped out. And I actually moved to Philadelphia. I had some friends that lived in West Philly, and I got a job carpooling kids in West Philly to some schools in Germantown, some schools for kids with learning disabilities. And I think they paid me $10 a week per child. And then eventually a school hired me to be an associate helper for a teacher.
Okay. At some point you meet Jim Coane.
I do.
Whose name we recognize from the hyphen in yours.
Yes.
That lasted. You ended up in Atlanta starting a business together.
We did, yes. Actually, he was the music person at this school where we worked. It was called Parkway Day School. We kind of hooked up that summer of 1970, and he was at Emory University. He went back to school. He was a senior. I was living on South Street. He flew up. He wrote me a song, and he sang it for me, and, you know, within 48 hours, we were driving to Atlanta, Georgia, in my beat-up Cortina or whatever. I don't know what I was driving then.
It
but
must
had
have
a
been
giant,
some song. Yeah.
Giant smashed-in door. It was one hell of a song. And you could do this in 1970, which is you get your friends together and you say, well, let's open a vegetarian macrobiotic restaurant. And we did. We each threw in some money, and there was this empty restaurant that we took over. And we called Morningstar Inn. We ordered 100-pound bags of brown rice. And once we ordered hot peppers, which we meant the other peppers, we learned the hard way, onions and flour and oil. And we opened a restaurant. And
did the public take to it?
Well, you could eat for a dollar. So you could have a vegetarian or macrobiotic special, which was brown rice, a vegetable or two, adduki beans, seaweed, and unleavened bread. How's that?
Wow.
For a dollar.
You ended up back in Philly. I mean, I want to get us to radio in a bit, but just list some of the other jobs that you had and where you worked in Philly.
Yeah. I went back and actually went to Temple University. I was we called ourselves waitresses back then, and I waitressed at a bunch of different restaurants. After college, I watered plants in businesses. I had a little terrarium business for about a week. I worked as a school counselor in Philadelphia for a federally funded program for a couple of years. I worked as a case manager in Kensington, actually, at a mental health center there. And that's when I heard public radio for the first time.
And you said, I got to get there.
And I said, I got to do this.
How did you do it?
Well, Jim, my husband, I said, I'm going to do radio now. And, you know, this is my 14th career. And I said, I'm going to go to graduate school and then I'll get a job in radio. He said, that's ridiculous. Go down to HYY and just go there and figure out if you like it and learn what you're good at and what you're not good at. And so that's exactly what I did.
Right.
He was right as usual. So.
Mm-hmm. I remember seeing you in the newsroom when I was there as an intern. Also in my late 20s, I guess about 29, kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And
yeah.
We both found a home. I followed the news course. You became a producer.
I did.
Of a show. It was called Voices. It was, what was it? Family Matters.
Family Matters.
That became migrated into Voices in the Family with... Right. Dr. Dan Gottlieb, right. How did you get that gig? What was it like? What did you learn?
Well, Bill Siemering, who is here tonight.
In the corner?
Somewhere.
A legend of public radio.
A legend of public radio. He's over there. He and I just put our heads together somehow and came up with this idea of a psychology show. I think my background as a counselor and also doing some case management in a community mental health center, I felt like, this is something I know a little something about. And I felt like I knew the city pretty well in terms of just the facilities and the people that worked here that we could have as guests on the show. And so we launched this program about, 40 years ago, something like that. And I eventually, Dan was a guest on the show. And, those moments when you just, it's like kismet. And that was Dan Gottlieb for me. And then I hired him to host the show. And, the rest is history, as I say.
You know, you also, at this relatively young stage in a radio career, you actually fired the original host, right?
I did.
We don't need to mention any names.
No,
but,
I would not want to mention his name.
I don't know.
And I'm looking at Bill. you learn, this was something I was learning on the air. And you learn on the air, I'm not sure you can do this now, about what is good and what works and how does a host connect with a guest and do they do their homework and does the audience connect? So, through process of elimination.
So what wasn't working there?
It was just a personality difference and I needed someone I could work with, to be perfectly honest with you. Yeah, it was tough.
You're listening to a conversation recorded last week with WHYY's Dave Davies, co-host of Fresh Air, interviewing me about how I ended up working at WHYY, how Radio Times got started. Much more after this very short break. You're listening to WHYY in Philadelphia.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and the tables have been turned today. Instead of me interviewing someone else, Dave Davies is interviewing me about how Radio Times got started 35 years ago. We spoke last week at a WHYY event. We're playing back portions of that interview today as we mark the end of Radio Times. This is the last program.
One of the great things about getting into public radio, and there are people here who made careers like this, you get in the building, and if you've got some talent, people see it and want you to do more. You did some producing for Fresh Air, which was then a local show, right?
Yep.
And did some interviews for them?
Or, I did,
yeah.
Yes.
And then, so then, where did you get this idea that, hey, how about I get a two-hour daily show?
Well, when Fresh Air went national, and Fresh Air was a two-hour-a-day show, and when Fresh Air went national to 1 hour a day, there was this stray hour, that needed to be filled. And so, again, Bill Siemering and I came up with this idea of Radio Times, of putting a show together, feeling as if there was more to be said, there was more that we could produce and present to the to our local audience here. So the show was born.
Right. And, you know, you'd show you had an aptitude for interviewing. I mean, you'd talk to people a lot in your social work.
Yes.
Was it easier or harder than you expected? What was it like getting good?
Oh, gosh. And I mean, to be honest with you, in the beginning, I doubt I was very good. I mean, I'm sure I was just too self-conscious. I didn't know how to prepare. I was probably intimidated by people that today I would not be intimidated by.
And was it 2 hours a day at the
beginning?
No,
it was just 1 hour.
Just one. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it started slowly. You know, you listen to yourself and you have to be self-critical. And so in the beginning, it was painful to hear things, but I used that as an opportunity to get better. To be honest with you, I watched Terry Gross. Like, how does Terry Gross do an interview? And I learned a lot from seeing how she did. And, you know, homework, preparation is so important, at least for me, you know, as a not very good student. I did have to do my homework.
Well, we have some tape from one of your early shows. Actually, we don't.
it's buried somewhere, but, Dave, I hope.
But if we did, what would we hear?
You would probably hear someone who's talking a little bit like this, who has a little more tentativeness in her voice, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm. Well, by the time I began appearing as a guest on the show, which I guess was, what, late 80s, early 90s, I'm not sure, I was a reporter. You were on top of it. You really had your game. I mean, every reporter that I knew listened to your show and wanted to be on the show. You know, one of the things about reporters is that they tend to, well, this isn't true in public radio today, but at the newspapers where I worked, I mean, they would come in a little late because they were going to be there till 6 or 7 every night anyway. So they would catch that first hour of Radio Times coming in, and they wanted to be on because there was nothing else like it in terms of way of a place to explore issues. You know, people hear the show and they think, well, somebody comes in, sits down, and Marty talks to him. I mean, like, why does that take a bunch of people? I mean, when I got to know the show and did some filling in for you, I mean, there were three full-time staffers there. Some of them are here, and they are terrific staffers.
Yes.
And they were busy. Help people understand why you need that many people to do a quality. It's an interview show, right? You're not,
absolutely.
Not, you know, it's just talking.
And let me say, doing 2 hours a day with three producers is unheard of. most shows have two and three and four times the number of people, but you hire really good people. That's one thing. And producers are the people that make it happen. I mean, honestly, it doesn't go on the air unless the producer has found the right guest, has pre-interviewed the guest, has made sure that if you have three or four guests, that they're evenly matched, and that this person can do that and that person can do that. There's a lot of research that has to go into it. We are always looking for audio elements that we can play on the show so that it's not just people talking, but you can hear clips. John Ahrens is here, and he was always good finding our Simpsons clips for whatever whatever topic we were going to talk about. But we're mining the news, we're mining TV shows and movies, and looking for clips to make it up. And then they have, you know, once the show goes live, they're tracking down the guests and making sure that their phone works and making sure that they are who they say they are, all that.
And callers. Right, right.
Of course.
And it's interesting you mentioned the audio elements, because that is a really important thing. And now we take for the granted that you can find stuff on YouTube. Not in the 80s. What did you do?
No, I mean, in the 80s, this was before the internet. It was just sort of insane to even think about that. We probably didn't do any of those things because we just didn't have the tools and the access to information to be able to put something like that on the air. In the early days, when we had interns, I literally would give them quarters and dimes, take the bus, go to the Free Library of Philadelphia, go down in the basement, use those dimes, copy newspaper articles, get back on the bus, and come. And that was my homework for the next day. And, of course, now you just sit in front of a computer and, boom, there it is.
Right. You know, it's. I mean, I've kind of listened in on some of your weekly meetings, and, you know, the start of a show is what's the topic, right? I mean, and a topic is good, then you have to have a guest. A good topic with a bad guest is a bad show.
Right.
You know, there are issues, but then you would come up with other stuff. Like, I remember, I don't know if this was Susan Greenbaum's idea or not, somebody, a show about crying. Let's just talk about crying.
Oh, yeah, right.
Was that you? I don't remember. I mean, and so you had an actor on who cried on demand. Am I
yes,
right?
We did. And they did cry on demand. Yeah.
Story.
But that's when you have producers who, maybe Susan saw, you know, some play and an actor cried on cue, and then, you know, the light bulb goes off, and then you come in and you say, well, let's do a show about crying.
Yeah. Was that you, Deborah Lissick? I can't even remember. You can't even remember, right? Anyway, you know, one of the things that I appreciated about Radio Times when it explored issues, particularly local issues, was that there was a real diversity of points of view. And, you know, if you think about, I think, a lot of the cable TV shows that a lot of us listen to these days, you know, a host comes on and gives a highly partisan analysis of something and then brings on a panel of three guests, all of whom agree with the analysis. And I always appreciated that when you went to Radio Times, you were going to get a diversity of views. I mean, if, you know, like, I might think that a soda tax to fund early childhood education is a great idea, but I know if I listen to your show, I'm going to hear the other side of that.
Right.
What did you have to learn about, you know, getting these people in and wrangling them so that it's interesting radio, but also elucidating and fair?
Yeah, and it wasn't always interesting radio and elucidating fair. I mean, again, you know, the sort of boring response to that is homework and preparation, finding two evenly matched people who could debate, let's say, a soda tax, which I'm sure we did do that. Trying to be, you know, fair and balanced, if I can put it that way, just making sure that everyone gets an equal shot, being willing to jump in if people are being overly argumentative or they're interrupting people, you know, that sort of having that mental clock just to make sure that when all is said and done, the listeners understand the other side. They each got to say their point. It wasn't completely hostile and overt. They're good disagreements. I mean, that's always a fun show. But just finding that right balance of all those things.
I wonder if you think it's harder to do shows like that nowadays, where partisanship has a whole different meaning and intensity.
Yeah. We really struggled with that. And, I have to say, within the last 4, 5, 6 years, and I think when conspiracy theories and lies and people willing to tout, you know, all this disinformation and misinformation, there's just no place for that, at least on Radio Times or on a respectable journalism show. So to be honest with you, and I'll just say early on in the Trump administration, we had people who represented that point of view. But over time, it was clear that they were not being honest. And that was just unacceptable. So we're probably more like those cable shows that you talk about now, which is like-minded people. Some things, there isn't another side. Early on, we used to debate climate change. There's no other side. You know, we're in it. And now we have to talk about how to get out of it.
When you can't get a good faith argument, we're in trouble.
Yes. Yes.
So let's talk about learning and mastering the art of interviewing. When you were doing 2 hours a day, that's 10 different shows a week. I can't imagine how you did the kind of prep you did for that, but somehow you did it. What did you do when a guest is nervous about being on the radio?
I don't know. I mean, you can't make someone be who they are not. But I could say those sort of slightly counseling things, which is to say, I loved your book. I have prepared, and I'm really interested in what you do. I mean, these are things you would say before going on the air to a nervous guest. I wouldn't say that to everybody, but to someone who you felt like maybe it's their very first novel that they've ever written and they've never been interviewed before, well, I'm going to give them a helping hand because I want them to succeed. So sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. You never know. It's live radio.
The real way you avoid that is by getting guests who are ready to at least say what they know. I remember one time you telling me about, there was, I don't remember who the guy was, what his subject was, but, you know, there were three segments in each hour.
Right.
And at the end of the second segment, I remember you told me, this is amazing to me that you did this, said, I can't even stand listening to this guy for a third segment. And do you remember this?
I do.
And what did you do?
Well, actually, it was after about 5 minutes. I didn't wait 40. We were talking about Canada, of all things. I don't know how we were talking about Canada. We found one of the producers, who shall remain nameless. No, I'm kidding. Found a comedian, and we just didn't hit it off. He didn't get what we were getting at. I didn't get what he was getting at. And so after about 5 or 10 minutes, it was just, we got to end this thing. I think we just did what we used to do in the olden days, an open show.
Open phones, right.
Open phones, you know. Always dangerous.
That's when you know you're comfortable in front of the microphone, when you can just say, let's talk.
That's it. We're done.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think of memorable guests. Wilt Chamberlain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this was, 30 years ago, I kind of forget. Wilt Chamberlain, of course, grew up here in Philadelphia, and he had written his memoir and was on a book tour. And he, for some reason, I had run out of the studio, and someone had brought him into the studio to sit opposite me. This was in the old building. And I ran in, you know, shook his hand, and literally, he just kept going up. And it was a delight because lots of friends from the neighborhood were calling in. And
went to Overbrook High School. Right?
Yeah, telling stories on him. He had written in his memoir that he had had 25,000 sexual encounters in his life. And I said to him probably the cleverest thing I've ever said in 35 years, which I said, you know, Wilt Chamberlain, you've got the whole country doing long division.
Well played.
That's it. That was probably the best thing I ever said over the years.
And then there's the day, and this is true.
Yeah.
Guest comes in with a box on his head.
Yes. Yes.
A legitimate journalist.
Well, everyone here knows who Craig LeBan is, right? Food critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This was early on in his, I'm not sure where in his career, but we thought, well, we'll have Craig LeBan on the show to talk about restaurants and restaurant reviewing and all sorts of strict requirements. We had to completely cover all the windows that you could see into the studio. People were, like, sworn to secrecy about what he looked like. We couldn't say anything. And literally the security guard walked him down the hall into the studio with a box on his head. And he did sit down and then take the box off. Probably would kill me if I, you know, had explained what he looked like.
But was it a custom box that he carries around?
No, you know? I know. I think the maintenance guy found it in the dumpster somewhere. But yeah, he did. But the weird thing is, about 3 weeks later, Salman Rushdie was a guest on the show, and this was he was living under a fatwa, so a death threat on his head. He doesn't have a box on his head. He's sitting out in our lobby reading the New York Times and just, you know, enjoying whatever. And to me, those two interviews always struck me.
And then there's the time in a political corruption trial in federal court, Marty Moscowen's name is mentioned.
Yes. And you were covering that trial,
yes,
right?
Yes, I remember this.
Yes. You know more about this case than I do, but Vince Fumo, well, people in Philadelphia know who Vince Fumo is.
A lot of people probably don't. He was a very powerful state senator who just
got in trouble.
Got in trouble.
a lot of trouble. And he was, I think, on trial and for whatever reason decided to be a guest on Radio Times. I'm sure his lawyer...
Under indictment, yeah.
He was, under indictment and completely spills the beans on the radio. And Dave is covering this, I guess, and all of a sudden, you know, in the courtroom, well, on Radio Times, you said blah, blah, blah.
Right. He had there was this community organization that associates of his had founded, which got a $17 million grant from PICO for reasons that aren't worth going into here. And he told the FBI that, no, I didn't benefit in any way. And then, of course, it turns out he got power tools and all kinds of stuff that they had owned. The interesting thing is that after the trial and when he was convicted on, I think it was 127 out of 127 counts, one of the jurors, Karen someone, was a longtime fan of Radio Times. And she was quoted as saying, He lied to Marty Moscowing. You can't lie to Marty Moscowing. So, a word to miscreants out there. Don't sit down with
right,
me.
Be careful what you say.
You take callers.
Yes.
It's live radio. Mm-hmm. It's always a little unpredictable. Mm-hmm. Any pranksters ever get on the air? Anything weird?
Oh, yeah. We had our Howard Stern pranksters. I mean, if you do live radio, you're gonna get everything under the sun. On the one hand, you're going to get that perfect caller that you need at that perfect moment who says that thing that you never would have thought of as the host or the guest, someone that just adds to the conversation. And those moments are really magic. And then, you know, you get someone who's cursing on the air or just goes completely off the rails or says, you know, Baba Booey, which, you know, for those Howard Stern fans, you know, that stuff happens as well.
While you're doing the show for 35 years, you have a life.
Yeah.
You have a son, Jesse, a husband, Jim. We've already mentioned him.
Yep.
I've been to your home. It's beautifully kept. You're a gardener. You play tennis. And you're dyslexic, so you have to read the books a bunch of times. I mean, how does all this work? I mean,
it all worked out fine, Dave. Yeah. I don't want you to worry.
Did you prepare every night before a show?
I did. I did. I mean, Jesse and I allegedly did our homework together. Right? Yeah, I did. I did. I mean, I got very good at sort of corralling myself and finding those 20 minutes here and there between making dinner and reading bedtime stories and whatever to pull the interview together. But I figured out a system that made it work so that I could have a life outside of work, which is very important to me.
More from my conversation with WHYY's Dave Davies about Radio Times, which marked its 35th anniversary earlier this year and ends today. You're listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowane. Let's get back to my conversation with Dave Davies.
I mean, among the things that we didn't mention that you also have to do, besides picking the guests and picking the topics and all that, you have copy that you have to write, you know, the parts, the promos and the recorded parts of the show. And then you also, as the executive producer, had to, in effect, run a business.
Yeah.
You had to hire people. You had to interview people when someone left. You had to manage people. Now, you had run a macrobiotic restaurant.
I had done
And
that.
A lot of other things. Yeah. I mean, a lot of other diverse kinds of experience. Was it hard to learn how to run an organization?
Yeah, well, it was hard to run a live radio show or an organization. I mean, only because you just have such a responsibility to the audience, but also because we're working so closely together. You know, we're on top of each other. We're shouting things back and forth. We're troubleshooting. And so you need people that you can trust, who can trust you, and finding that right mix of people was always important. And when you do it, it's magic. I mean, it makes going to work fun. Most of my producers are also hilariously funny. So we've laughed a lot while we've been putting shows together.
Now, they've been some of my favorite people, I will admit.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a guest on the show a bunch of times, and then I filled in for you for a small fraction of those 19,000.
Right.
You and I are around the same age. We share a birthday, as it happens.
With Terry Gross.
Right. Just this weird thing at the
very
station.
Very strange.
Something weird. I'm wondering how you have felt, how aging has affected you.
Well, I don't feel old, but I feel mortal. If there's a difference, I do feel the passage of time. It's funny, Jim and I went to see Leonard Cohen's documentary. It's called Hallelujah. It's the song that he wrote, and it's full of interviews. And at one point, he talks about being in your 70s, where I'm in my 70s. And he says, you know, it's the foothills of old age. And when he said that, I just said, yes, it is. So I still feel like I've got life in me. I'm healthy. I've got energy. I want to see the world. There are things I want to do. But I also feel the clock ticking, you know. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, my parents died when they were 80. So I don't know. You know, there's that. So, but it also makes you feel very alive and very grateful and very aware that, you know, we get this one shot on Earth and got to make the best of it.
Have you lost anything, do you think, in terms of mental acuity?
I don't.
I will just say I have.
No.
I have.
It's hard to know because I don't sleep very well. So I say to myself, you know, if I could get those good night's sleep, maybe I would be sharper. I'm sure I have, you know. As producers who work with me will say, and I'll say, who was the guest we had yesterday? And what did we talk about? So there's that.
Yeah. Do you worry at all about losing your identity as the person who has had this show? Now, you're not leaving radio altogether,
no,
but...
I don't. You know, I don't think about that. I've never thought a lot about being Marty Moss Cohen, if you know what I mean. I feel like this is my job and this is what I do. I'm mostly invisible. Most people have no idea what I look like or sound like. And so I've been able to live, you know, a very, very free, an anonymous life in a lot of ways. So I'm not going to miss that.
Good. What can you tell us about the new show?
Yeah, the new show, and thank you to HYY for letting me come up with something completely different. It's going to be called The Connection, and it's going to be a much more philosophical show about a little bit about the foothills, about how to live a meaningful life, about how to be connected to other people. I think of the word connection as so important to being a person, you know, being connected to other people. Connection and attachment. I mean, that's just essential to life and survival. And radio is a place where we can all connect. So I want to have conversations about the meaning of life and the meaning, what are we on this earth for? So I hope to talk to psychologists and philosophers and adventurers and journalists and activists and deep sea divers, you know, all of that.
Well, we should wrap this up, but before we go on to some people who are going to share some memories and say a few nice things, I just want to share a thought of my own.
Yes.
You know, there are a lot of people who are great talents, and then when you get to know them, you find that they're not necessarily great people. They don't always match up. I mean, I've really observed you in a lot of different ways over a long time, and it's remarkable to me that the warm, intelligent, curious person that people hear on the radio is really who you are. But beyond that, it's amazing to me because when I look at all you are handling over the course of a day and a week, I don't think I've ever seen you lose your patience or snap at someone. And there's just never been an ounce of diva. I mean, you're of someone of real stature. And I think the way that you have conducted yourself in the station has set an example for a lot of people. So I just want to say, I think you're not just a terrific broadcaster, you're a leader, and we've been lucky to have you.
Oh, thank you, Dave.
And I'm glad we're going to keep you.
Yeah. Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate that. I also want to just take me a little bit off my high horse here. We do have a little clip from some hate mail.
Oh, gosh, I forgot the hate mail.
Mail.
Yeah, explain this. Yes.
All right. Well, this at the 30th anniversary of Radio Times, I was trying to think, what are we going to do that's special? And anyone that does anything like live radio or radio at all gets hate mail. And I asked Jennifer Childs of 1812 Productions if she would take some of my hate mail and turn it into a performance. And she did. So this is Jennifer Childs, David Jadico, and Emily Climo. Let's give it a listen.
Marty Moskowitz's hate mail. A dramatic reading in one act. Greetings, Marty Moskowitz. Today I heard you use impacts as a verb. I've never heard you use it before. I hope you never use it again. Please use effects instead. Thank you. Best regards.
I'm a regular listener who thinks Marty is just great, which is why I want her to know that the plural of thesis is theses, not either of the two words she just made up just now.
Marty, when you thank someone for being there and they say thank you in response, you don't have to say you're welcome.
I love your program. But you have one little speech error that really annoys me. You leave the L out of Pennsylvania.
Marty, please pronounce the L in Pennsylvania. It certainly would be nice if you pronounce the state you live in properly. Pennsylvania has an L in the spelling.
You say Pennsylvania.
You pronounce it like Pennsylvania. You pronounce it like Pensacola. You should pronounce it like Pennsylvania. It is unbecoming to you as an intelligent person. It sounds ignorant, provincial, and not in a good folksy way.
Oddly enough, Governor Rendell has the same defect.
Rendell does this too. For him, is he trying to get votes for sounding folksy? You and Governor Rendell should be ashamed that neither one of you can pronounce correctly the state in which you live. Pennsylvania! You know, I've heard you mispronounce many words, but the ones that come to mind at the moment are the following. The noun house is pronounced house. And the plural, houses, is pronounced
houses.
Houses. Horrifyingly, one has started to hear house is, or even
house is.
Over the air. The verb to house in its several forms should always be pronounced
house.
Thank you. But, please, Marty, stop using the word but so much. It feels disrespectful to the guest and to the listener. Listen to your own show and count the number of times that you use the word but during an interview.
I counted at least 119 kind of and sort of expressions, which easily shattered Marty's previous record of 68 7 years ago. Please try to control your distracting stammer. There must be a speech therapist who can help you. Perhaps WHYY or NPR would like me to deliver a lecture or two on stammering.
You are too respected of a veteran broadcaster to permit yourself the sloppiness of projecting continual audible lip smacking into your speech as though such amateurish labial practices were part of sound broadcasting technique. The method to rid yourself of lip smacking is simple. Having your lips slightly parted before beginning speech and having enough moisture on your lips to minimize any sort of audible smacking, breaking labial suction easily eliminate this issue. Blasting such jarring, dissonant pop marks like that lip smacking into a microphone is horrendously disrespectful toward the quality of product you deliver. It is a significant consternation that you allow such admittedly disgusting sounds to escape your lips. I would hope that greater pride would be taken than to directly subject listeners to lip smack.
Your station is really pushing the envelope. When you encourage and or permit the kind of garbage that we heard on the Marty Moskowitz program today, we can only assume that there are no broadcasting standards and practices left for the decent people who listen to WHYY.
Marty, for years I gave you the benefit of the doubt on fairness. I assume, as a privileged yuppie of the 60s, you were blinded by your upbringing and background. But by now, I would expect you, if you wanted, would at least understand there is another opinion and respect those that hold them to at least an effort to fairness. You haven't. You remain a privileged, middle-class ideologue who is isolated from reality. Bertie Wasserwig, user a liar extraordinaire. All your validity you spout. Vomit. Wish I had compassion for you. Just view you as a total sellout pretending to cur.
You are the part of the problem in America, Marty Mustaine. That's why I think of you as mommy most inane.
Get Marty Mustaine off the air. She has no talents. I usually love your program, but did not want to hear about fungus, bats, and other disgusting things, not the bats themselves, at 11 at night. Maybe you could avoid unpleasant things for your 11 p.m. rebroadcast. I'm listening in bed, and I'm sure some others are, too. What happened to the days when you had wonderful authors?
You are so good at what you do. I really enjoy your show. Moreover, you are so beautiful. I saw you online during pledge support at 3:30 p.m. on Monday, October 21st, 2002. You look so cute. I love your hairstyle, too.
Marty. I love your program, but...
I'm a regular listener, but...
I usually love your program, but...
But.
What happened?
Would it be so hard?
Impact. Houses.
PCs.
Pennsylvania.
And thanks to 1812 Productions. Well, that's a wrap. This is the last Radio Times program, and I have so many people to thank. First of all, thanks to Dave Davies for this interview. He's a dear friend, a trusted colleague, and an extraordinary journalist. Thanks to WHYY CEO Bill Morazzo, who has supported Radio Times and me over the years. Thanks to all my WHYY bosses and the WHYY staffers who do extraordinary work every single day. Special thanks to Bill Seemring for being a mentor to me. His passion for radio is contagious. Thanks to Dan Gottlieb for teaching me how to be a producer and how to be vulnerable on the air. Thanks to Terry Gross and Danny Miller for your support and encouragement over the years. It meant the world to me, opened many doors. Thanks to the thousands of guests who shared your stories and ideas, adding so much richness to our region. There have been a number of fill-in hosts over the 35 years, Karen Turner, Alexis Moore, Linda Wrightmore, Dave Davies, Mike and Scott, Kevin McCrory, Katie Meyer, and Malcolm Burnley. Thanks to all of you. Thanks to Mary Cummings Jordan, who hosted the Radio Times Regional Roundup on Mondays, who brought her know-how, her curiosity, her engaging warmth to the show every week. Thanks to Tracy Matisak, who filled in for me for many years so I could take vacations. She is the consummate broadcast professional. Nothing gets on the air unless you have a talented engineering staff, and I've been lucky to work with many of them. Joyce Lieberman, Diana Martinez, Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, Adam Stanishevsky, and Audrey Bentham. And absolutely nothing gets on the air without a talented, resourceful, creative, hardworking, and caring team of producers who have left their mark on the show. There were 22 of them. Barbara Bogave, Yvonne Jones, Penny Nelson, Jackie Posey, Tamika Artist, Devorah Lissick, Jonathan Best, Christine Dempsey, Alan Tu, Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, Debbie Builder, Sophie Reed, Sarah Edelman, Emily Bryant Alvarez, Liz Fiedler, John Ahrens, Trine Nuri, Kelsey Hansen, Alex Stern, and Paige Murray Bessler. And thanks to my wonderful little family, Jim Cohen, and our son, Jesse Moss Cohen. And finally, my thanks to you, our listeners. You inspired me. You surprised me. You sometimes made me cry. You sometimes made me mad. You made Radio Times a much better show. Thank you so much. I'm Marty Moss Cohen.